Chapter 2. During the fortnight that followed the lookout's room in the old empty house, marked Bunham's Patient Locks Limited, became the center for the collection of all the gear that might turn out to be useful on the expedition. Under the watchful eye of Knocker, it was stacked and sorted. Accepted or refused, everything was entered into a large ledger. Anything left over was going to be raffled, so there was great interest in the high street, and many of the Borables were excelling themselves in collecting material. Of course, a lot of others took no interest at all, and if they found something useful amongst the loot, well, they just kept it. There were life jackets from the sports sections of Ardred's and Knobs, thick, warm coats from Walker's, sleeping bags, unbreakable nylon rope for climbing up trees and the sides of houses, stout boots, oilskins, woolen underwear, sharp knives, solweisters, ski goggles, corduroy trousers with knee pads and small shoulder satchels converted into rucksacks. Looking at his inventory, Knocker felt pleased. Every eventuality had been foreseen. The store cupboard was full, and the lookout's room was piled high with valuable items. The only space left clear in a small area around his desk and a kind of corridor to each of the doors. One day his contented musing was interrupted by Lightfinger, who came in the improvised warehouse and sidled between the goods towering above his head. "You look tired," he said. "I am that," answered Knocker. "I think I've got everything now, though I suppose I'm bound to have forgotten something." "Well, you haven't finished yet, mate," said Lightfinger. "Spiff wants to see you right away upstairs." Knocker ran up the ground floor landing and knocked on Spiff's door. "Come in," cried the rough voice, and Knocker did so. "Ah, there you are, Knocker. Sit down. Good news. They're here." "Who?" asked Knocker, who was very tired, and whose mind was still counting hot water bottles and ice axes. "Oh, come on," said Spiff. "The champions, the brightest of the Borables, the magnificent eight, the two-thirds of a dozen. Call 'em what you like. They're here." "Where?" asked Knocker, sitting up in his chair. "They're in the storeroom under the gym at 45 Rowena Crescent, on the other side of Prince's Head. I want you to put them through the basic and advanced lookout training, even if they're lookouts already. Make sure they're first-class thieves, good at shoplifting, woolly dodging, and see that they know the Borable proverbs all by heart. The usual kind of thing. Then take them on a few courses in Battersea Park. I know they don't like the countryside, but they've got to get used to it. Rumbledom's rough. I'll give you a fortnight, that's all. There'll be another bloke to help you. He's from the North Court Road lot. Was brought up in a paratrooper's family before he was Borabled. He could be useful. By the way," Spiff threw over some books, and Knocker caught them in his lap. "You'd better read these from cover to cover. They're the Rumble manuals. The whole history from the word go gives the layout of the place, the structure of their command, the way they fight with their rumble sticks. Nasty prodders they are. 4-inch nail at the end. Everything's there. Get on with it, Knocker. I'll come and see you in 2 weeks' time. If there's anything you need, send a runner." Knocker gathered up the books and got up to leave, but he was stopped. "Oh, yes. In the first volume, I've made a list of the 8 high rumbles of Rumbledon, their names. We thought it would be a good idea if you gave each of your Borables one of those names to win. So if they ever get that far, your blokes will know exactly which rumble he's got to do for. Good idea, isn't it?" "How shall I give them out? Did you decide that?" Spiff laughed to himself mysteriously. "You'd better put the names in a hat and let them draw for 'em. Then there could be no argument about the targets they are given." The steward hesitated and then laughed again. "That is, except 2 of 'em. Those you'll have to put into a separate hat. You'll see 'em marked on the list. Go on, buzz off, Knocker." Knocker whistled as he went down the stairs. He would dearly have loved to go on the expedition, and to have learned a new name and a new story. But fancy going through life with a rumble title. That would be strange. Then he reflected that it was not the name, after all, but the story it carried that mattered. He could think of some fine Borables with the most extraordinary monikers, but when you saw them or heard their names, you didn't think of the word alone, or its sound. You thought of the life and the deeds that lay behind it. The story. Stories are very important to Borables. Most of the time they can't have a real adventure because they're too busy. But they read tales that deal with exciting things, like westerns or spy stories or science fiction. For a Borable, the next best thing to an adventure of his own is hearing other Borables recount their adventures and how they won their names. That's why they like doing outlandish things, so they can tell their stories afterwards and exaggerate what happened. They liked winning their adventures, of course, but just like most other people, they often lose. But that is all right, as long as it makes for a good story. Knocker left the house and made his way up to High Street. There was no doubt in his mind as he threaded his way along the pavements. The 8 champions who were going on this adventure would have wonderful stories to tell. The rumble names they were going to win remind them of their targets during the expedition. In years to come, if they were successful, everyone who heard the names would know how they had been won. Yes, concluded Knocker as he turned onto Rowena Crescent. A clever idea. Outside number 45, Knocker stopped to make sure his hat was on firmly. The gym was a long, low building looking like an empty pub, faced with green tiles. Above the door, 3 long windows where there was a notice board. Knocker looked up at it, though he knew what it said. Rowena Gym. Tough guys for stage and screen and TV. Stuntmen, Kung Fu, Latina Market Prop. Knocker could hear grunts and groans coming from the inside. That would be the adults trying to break into the big time. In the pavement, he saw the telltale grills showing him the basement where the Borables would be. Tightening his grip around in the rumble books, Knocker went through the main entrance and down a corridor that was tiled the same dirty color as the front of the building. A porter threw open his door to his office and stood right in front of the pint-sized Borable. He looked huge, with his legs spread and his hands on his hip. He had a cauliflower ear, and his breath smelled sickly sweet with brown ale. "Where do you think you're going, mush?" "It's all right," lied Knocker. "My big brother's here, and I gotta give him these books. I'm late already." The man nodded slowly. "Okay. But don't hang about. Kids ain't allowed in here, especially little squirts like you. I'll clip you around the ear, I will." Knocker shuddered at the idea and pulled his hat down his head and bobbed away. At the end of the corridor, Knocker found 2 staircases, one going up, the other down. Knocker allowed one of his books to fall to the ground. As he picked it up, he looked under his arm and saw that the doorman was still watching. Knocker went up to the first floor, waited a while, and then crept back down the stairs. The corridor was now empty, so he descended the dank basement steps until it became so dark that he had to feel his way. He groped along the wall until he came up to a rough wooden door, which did not give when he pushed it. He gave the Borable knock, gently at first, and then when nothing happened, he knocked a little louder. 1 long, 2 shorts, then a long. Da, dee dee da. Then there was a slight noise behind the door. A bolt clanged and a lock clashed and an eye peered out through the slit. Borable? Asked the person behind the door. Borable, answered Knocker. The door was open enough for Knocker to pass through it, and then it was closed and bolted behind him. He found himself in a long, dusty room with exercise bars covering each wall from floor to ceiling. From the central beams hung thick ropes for climbing. Mats were piled on the parkwood flooring, and Knocker could see all kinds of equipment for improving the efficiency of the human machine. The room was lit by long, narrow windows situated under the grills that Knocker had seen on the pavement outside. The light that slanted across the room was gray and faltering, losing itself before it reached the corners. It was so dull that Knocker could hardly make out the 8 shape sitting quietly on the bench at the far end of the gym. The chief lookout turned to the Borable next to him. "Northcote Road?" he asked, and his companion nodded. "Name's Dodger," he said, and he smiled. "Sounds like a good name," said Knocker. "You must have had a good adventure getting it. You must tell me one day." "Everyone knows how you got your name, Knocker. That's one of the best Borable stories ever told." It's usual for Borables meeting for the first time to exchange compliments on their respective names and the winning of them. Until they have a name, Borables are simply known as You, Oi, or Mush, or sometimes Flingy, or even was his name. To call a named Borable by one of the foregoing is an unforgivable insult and will lead to fighting. Borables are great scrappers, mainly because they're used to it. An even greater insult for a Borable is to hint that he acquired his name only because he'd found it, or someone had thrown it away. To an unnamed one, it is very galling to have suggested that he is nameless because no one had yet had the devious ingenuity to invent an epitaph bad enough for him. Knocker inspected the Northcote Road Borable, and he liked what he saw. It seemed to him that they would get on. He smiled. Instead of the usual woolen cap, Dodger wore an army beret of a dark color. Stuck to it was the badge of a parachute regiment, shining bright. "Army background," observed Knocker. "Oh, yes," said Dodger proudly. "Parachute regiment and SAS until I became a Borable. Might not have run away at all if they hadn't wanted to pack me off to some school. Up until then, I spent all my time watching soldiers doing their training. That was the life. Knocker laughed. Well, we better get going. We haven't got all that long. They turned from the door and strolled down the long hall, their feet kicking into the piles of rubbish, released stale smells from the old cartons. How'd you get in here? Said Knocker. Dodger pointed to the ceiling. I had the bolts off a couple of these grills in the pavement. Easy. That way we won't have to go past old Punchy and the porter every day. I'll remember that next time. The eight sat motionless on the bench. Some leaned back against the wall with their eyes closed, some held their head in their hands, and others sat looking straight in front of them, staring at Knocker. At a sign from Knocker, Dodger switched on some electric lights and the Borables blinked their eyes. Stand up! Hats off! When they had done what Knocker said, he walked down the line and inspected their ears, to see if they showed signs of the intelligence he was expecting. It was a maneuver that gave him time to think. He would have admitted to no one, apart from Spiff, perhaps, that he was flabbergasted. One of the champions, he noticed, was black. Of course, he knew many Borables were black, and more all the time. There were a lot in Battersea, Tooting, and a greater number even in Brixton. He just hadn't thought of one on this expedition. He had no one to blame but himself for this oversight. He was chief lookout, and his mind should have been open to all possibilities, not drifting around in preconceptions. Mentally, he kicked himself for being a fool. He hadn't finished kicking himself yet. When he stopped at the end of the row, he found the last two Borables were females. His surprise nearly got the better of him, but he pursed his lips and pretended to be thinking. One of the girls smiled, and to cover his embarrassment, Knocker looked closely at her ears. They indicated a high degree of intelligence and great individuality. And that could mean trouble. Now Knocker knew why Spiff had laughed, and why he'd said he'd have to put two of the names in different hats. Knocker went back to where Dodger stood, handed over the Rumble books, and took a list of names from his pocket. He looked at it, making the eight champions wait. Finally he said, "You will be here for 2 weeks. We're going to see how good you really are. When Dodger and I have satisfied ourselves about your basic knowledge, we will move on to more specialist skills. But before that, I want to be convinced that you are good. Good with a catapult, good with your hands, good with your feet. I want you to be the best runners, the best fighters. I want to see how you deal with adults in tricky situations. You'd better be the best if you want to go on this trip. Because if I don't think you are, you aren't going." Knocker looked along the faces, scrutinizing them one after the other. "Anyone hears an order from me or Dodger, jump. That's against the grain for a Borable. I know it. But there hasn't been an adventure like this in years. And if you want to be on it, you gotta do what I say. Any questions?" There were no questions. "Good. Now to the names. It was decided at the stewards' meeting to give you names now, provisionally." There was a stir in the line and eyes flashed. "This is to make it more convenient for me during training, and for all of you when you're out on the adventure. These names will not be confirmed until you return, if you ever make it. These names have been lent to you on trust. One false step at any time, your name will be withdrawn, and you will never be given another adventure." There was silence. The eight faces looked at him and waited. They were tense and excited, but these Borables were too canny to give much away in their expressions. Knocker liked that. He went on. "These are fine names. Names that have a good ring to them, and will remind you and others in the future of this adventure. But more important, the name each of you will be given is also the name of the Rumble that is your individual target. Will you remember your own name? You cannot forget the name of your enemy." Knocker paused. He knew that each Borable standing before him could hardly wait for the moment when he would carry a name. The one word that would sum up and symbolize a whole life. "All right," went on the chief lookout. "The names will be distributed by drawing lots. 6 names in one hat, 2 names in another. Dodger?" Dodger and Knocker removed their hats, and Knocker tore each name separately from the sheet that Spiff had given him. He put 6 names into his own woolen cap, and 2 into the red beret of the paratroops. Dodger held the beret, while Knocker shook his own hat vigorously to mix the names fairly and squarely. "I'll start at one end and move along," he said. "It's all the luck of the draw." He studied the face of the first person in line. By chance, it was the one he had recommended to Spliff. The Battersea Borable from Lavender Hill Nick. Knocker had always liked the look of him, Although they didn't know each other very well, he was slightly built, even for a Borable. His skin was clear, his hair was dark and tightly curled, and like wire wool. His eyes were sharp and blue, and they moved quickly, but they were never furtive. He smiled a lot, and Knocker could see that it would take a lot to get him down. He glanced at Knocker, winked, and then plunged his hand into the hat. He pulled out a scrap of paper and he opened it. He read it to himself and then smiled to the chief lookout. He rolled his tongue about, getting the feel of the name for the first time. "Bingo," he said. "The name's Bingo." "That is a good name," said Knocker. Stepped sideways, stood in front of the black Borable. "Where are you from?" said Knocker. "Tooting, man. Tooting. And you?" Knocker raised his head sharply. "I'm from here." The Tooting Borable, or Totter, had hair standing up in thick, solid, uncut mass all around his head like a black halo. His teeth protruded and he seemed to be smiling all the time, but really his expression was one of cheerful slyness. Knocker liked that. He shook the hat, and the Totter took a piece of paper. "My name is going to be Orokoko," he said, splitting the word into separate syllables, pronouncing them with care. The next person was smaller than Bingo, even. He had a triangular face with a pointed chin, and his mousy hair lay flat across the top of his head. He had a way of wagging his head in a most knowing way. "There wasn't a trick he didn't know," said his eyes. Knocker stopped in front of him with the hat, and the Borable said, "I'm from Stephanie, the best place in the world." Knocker nodded and offered the hat. Stephanie Borable looked at the name on the paper he had drawn and whistled, and then he said, "Good. I've got the best. Vulgarian, the Chief Rumble. I don't reckon his chances when I catch up with him." "I see you've read the books, so you know why you're here?" "Course, to get a name. And because they said it was going to be the best adventure ever," said the Borable, and they all glanced up and down the line. The others nodded in agreement. "You gotta convince me that you're good enough first. Then you go," said Knocker. "Perhaps you ought to start by showing us that you're good enough to train us," said a brittle voice to Knocker's right. But Knocker ignored it and moved a step. "I'm from Peckham," said the next one, without being asked. He thrust his hand into the hat and pulled out his name. Knocker watched him closely as he read the paper. He seemed to be strong and resourceful. He had dark, heavy eyebrows and a red face with a firm jaw and enormous shoulders and arms. The kind of bloke who would not mince his words. Not very witty, perhaps, but dogged and persistent. "Well," said Knocker, "which one have you got?" The Peckham Borable did not even show pleasure as he said, "I got the name I wanted. Stonks. The keeper of the great door of Rumbledom." "He's the strongest one, ain't he?" "He'll need to be when I hit him." When Knocker came face to face with the next person, he wrinkled his nose. There was an unmistakable smell from this one, and Knocker guessed immediately where he came from. "You're from Wandsworth, aren't you? A Wendell?" "So what? Some of the finest Borables in the world have come from Wandsworth." Knocker recognized at once the brittle voice that had spoken out of turn earlier. "And some of the worst," he retorted, smiling a smile that had no warmth in it. In common with most other Borables, he wasn't overfond of the aloof Wandsworth Brotherhood. They lived along the banks of the River Waddle, in the disguised sewers and smelly holes that they had scooped out below the streets of Wandsworth. No one knew exactly how they lived, for they were the most suspicious and warlike of all the Borables, and did not encourage visitors, and rarely spoke to anyone outside their own tribe. Their skin always had a green tinge to it, which came from living so much underground and being often in and out of the filthy Wandle water. Once the Wandle had been a pleasant stream, but years of industrialization had turned it into treacherous ooze of green and muddy slime. The mud was a mixture of poison waste, decomposed rubbish, and undigested lumps of plastic which rolled slowly along the surface of the skin of the river as it slid like a thick jelly down to the Thames. The Wandle mud would entrap any stranger who was foolhardy enough to wade across it without guidance. No one but the Wendells knew the secret paths along the river, and they would only take a traveler across for a price. Every Wendell carried the smell of Wandsworth marshes with him, and that smell was the smell of treachery and decay. Knocker had seen a few Wendells. None of them had been this close, and he didn't like what he saw. The green tinge to the flesh, the dark eyes of an indeterminate color, the cold, proud bearing of the born scrapper. There seemed to be no spontaneous warmth in the Wendell, and the warmth normally is the first thing that was noticed in a Borable. "Take your name anyway," said Knocker flatly, and held out the hat. The Wendell narrowed his eyes and screwed up his mouth to prove that he didn't care a damn about Knocker or anyone else, and he pulled his name. He nodded, and then he laughed out loud, pleased and hostile. "Out with it," said Knocker impatiently. "What is it?" "What a name I have," he cried. "I shall cover it in glory. Or mud." The Wendell ignored Knocker and looked up and down the line of adventurers. "Napoleon Boot," he said loudly. "Call me Napoleon Boot." "And I suppose you know why you're going to Rumbledom," said Knocker. "Why am I going?" The other was angry. "What's wrong with you? Because I hate them, that's why. I've always hated them. And if you had always had them leering down at you from Rumbledom like I have, you'd hate them as much as I do. I don't need these other seven to come up to the burrow with me. I'll tear it apart on me, Todd." Knocker shrugged. He was glad to move on to the last of the male Borables. He looked at the face and liked it. It was square and flat, and the eyes were optimistic under spiky brown hair. This Borable seemed like he could take a lot of knocks and still come up smiling. "Well," he said, "as I am last, I hardly have to take the name out, do I? I mean, I've seen the books, too, like the others, even in Hoxton. So I know my name now. It's Torrey Cannon." Knocker gave the empty hat to Dodger and took the beret with the two names. He stood in front of the two Borable girls and felt embarrassed. He was used to girls, of course, but not to be trained as lookouts. He didn't like the idea of girls on this adventure, and wondered how it had happened. He looked from one to the other of them. He was forced to admit that they were tough-looking, and certainly their ears were among the most beautifully shaped he had ever seen, denoting strong character, unbendable wills, great slyness and cunning. He couldn't fault them there, but he thought, they'll never be able to support the rigors of the trek, the dangers, the rough living outdoors, every night in a different bivouac. And what effect would they have on the team as a whole? That's what really worried him. He knew Borables. They would quarrel and fight just as well as they would steal. Knocker glanced back down at the line and found the others watching him closely. Arakako was smiling, his white teeth shining against his black skin. Even the Wendell, Napoleon Boot, was smirking. "Where are you girls from?" asked Knocker.
"Whitechapel," said the first.
"Nesden," said the second.
Knocker held out the hat to the girl from Whitechapel.
"Take one of these," he said.
The girl took out a piece of paper and read her name simply with no comment.
"Shallot,"
she said, her voice cool and relaxed. Her green eyes flickered over Knocker's face and she smiled. Knocker thought she was beautiful. Her hair fell to her waist and was blonde. Her skin shone and her legs were well-shaped and long. He gave the last piece of paper to the girl from Nesden.
"Sydney," she said when she looked at it.
Knocker looked at her. Her hair was dark and shiny, and her eyes were gray, and her face was kind.
"Why did Whitechapel and Nesden send you two?" he asked, disguising his shyness behind a sarcastic tone.
"Haven't they got any male Borables out there?"
Shallot said. The message that came to Whitechapel specified a female Borable.
"And the Nesden message?"
Shallot nodded. "And if you look at the Rumble books, you'll see that two of the High Command are female. That's why we were asked, I should think."
"Hmm," said Knocker. He went to move away from them, and then turned suddenly, raising his voice. "There will be no favoritism. You will be treated just like the others. No difference at all. You will march like the others, you will train like the others, you will sleep on the ground like the others, and you will wear the same combat clothes. When you leave, you must expect the same conditions exactly. You will march as long, eat as little, and fight as much as every other member of this expeditionary force. No favors, so ask for none. You will take the same risks as the others, and maybe perish with them. Do you understand?" If Knocker had hoped to frighten Shallot and Sydney with his outburst, he had failed. They looked at each other, and then looked at the chief lookout.
"That is why we came," said Shallot, and quoted a Borable proverb. "No name earns itself."
"Yes," said Sydney. "We know the score. Any time you think we aren't up to scratch, you send us back."
Knocker turned again and walked to where he could address them all.
"Right," he began. "Now you have your names. Training will last a fortnight. All day and every day. I'll give you the details tomorrow. First thing you must do is learn your enemy. We have the Rumble books here, but we have something that is better. Spiff's notes and studies of the enemy and their way of life. We will start reading right away."
In his notes, you will find a detailed description of each of the rumbles of high command. Now you know your names, you know which one is yours, and you must know exactly what he or she looks like. You will have to distinguish between him and 1,000 others right in the middle of the punch-up. Another thing, we shall be training with the rumble stick, or sticker, the enemy's weapon, a 4-inch nail stuck to the end of a lance of wood. They use it like a spear or as a quarterstaff and dagger combined. The rumble is good with it. He cuts his teeth on it. You've got to be better. From now on, we work hard. Your survival will depend on this training. The next 2 weeks were weeks of exhausting activity. 8 members of the expeditionary force never stopped working. Every morning at 5, Knocker had them on their feet for 30 minutes of physical jerks, just to get the blood circulating properly through their brains. After breakfast, they had a morning training session inside the gym, the subject chosen by Dodger or Knocker. They did things like rumblestick combat, adult evasion, impromptu excuse-making. They perfected their tactics for stealing in pairs and in fours, and they practiced racing starts and fast running, for all borables are rapid movers. Before lunch, they slipped out for a quick run, just a mile or so to improve their wind. To keep them trim, Knocker made them responsible for stealing their own midday meal, and they all ate it together in some uncomfortable spot along the river on some windswept bomb site or in some drafty house with no windows. This was to get them used to the conditions they would meet when they set out on the adventure itself. Knocker watched the girls closely, but they never complained, and they did everything just as well as everyone else. After the midday meal, they went back to the gym for a short rest of 30 minutes or so, and then Knocker would test them on borable knowledge and on rumble studies. This was the kind of information that each expedition member was expected to have at his fingertips. He tested them a lot, so that every one of them had a mind as sharp and as hard and as useful as a brand new tin opener. They learned practical information, too, about how to avoid capture, how to escape when caught, and how to aid other borables when in trouble. Knocker insisted that the 8 of them should have all this knowledge ready in their minds so they could pop up automatically. There was no telling what they might come across on the long, dangerous journey to Rumbledom, and they would have to be prepared for anything and everything. After the session with the books, there was always more physical training. Dodger taught them how to jump from a great height and fall without hurting themselves, how to take punches rolling with the blow, how to duck and weave. He taught them the vulnerable spots of the rumble anatomy, and again, how to use the rumble stick. Then, in the latter part of the afternoon, Knocker, who'd had a great deal of experience, more than any known borable, taught them field tactics, which was all about crossing commons and parks. He took them into the wildest terrain, like the middle of Clapton Common, which was very open and deserted. Just the place for rumbles to burrow in secret and establish themselves unnoticed. Like other borables, Knocker much preferred crowded streets with markets and shops. But unlike others, he'd been obliged, because of his calling, to do an enormous amount of country work. Somehow, he'd made himself overcome the basic fear the borables have when faced with woods and fields. They hate such things. Fields, they say, are always windy, and there's nowhere to hide, and no crowds to get lost in, and there's nothing to pick up, and no lorries for things to fall off of. It's not so bad when the sun is hot, and a borable can lie under the shade of a tree looking at the sky moving between the branches. But even then, a borable really likes to be up to something in the street. In spite of all this, Knocker forced his team to undertake many a journey to Battersea Park, and he taught them how to listen to the sound underneath the ground, told them that a rumble or a mole or a rat was down there. They learned how to climb trees, and how to jump from them, and how to crawl through the bushes. But over and above all this, Knocker made them train hour after hour with the borables' traditional preferred weapon. It had been used by them for generations. It had been chosen for its simplicity, its range, its power, and its deadliness. It was a weapon that was very ancient, but as efficient as any modern invention. It could be made anywhere, and back in the days of the 19th century, when borables had endured great hardships, it had been hounded from place to place. It had become their favorite method of defense because of the cheapness of its manufacture. The weapon, of course, was a very dangerous one, the catapult. Every borable was born an expert with the catapult, but the 8 would have to surpass the usual standards and become boringly accurate, able to hit a rumble on the snout each time they fired. "You must never miss," Knocker told them. "You will have a great deal of provisions to carry. But if you all keep 10 stones in reserve, you should be able to count for 80 of the enemy between you. If you are besieged, always choose somewhere where you can find plenty of ammunition lying about, and then you will be invincible." And so each of the 8 became a crack shot. Every one of them could take a fly off the parkkeeper's nose at 100 yards, and he'd never even notice. That was how every day was filled. After the daily sortie to the park, they returned to Rowena, where they found the High Street Borables had provided them with a supper of food taken from the market. They ate with huge appetites, and after talking to each other for a little while, they rolled up in their sleeping bags and snoozed on the floor of the long, dusty room. The next day they would have to wake early and do the same things again. Run a little faster, shoot a little straighter. They would have to tackle difficult questions and find new answers to the problems that Knocker would devise. He would make them go over the expedition route and the street map of London, and play war games where he would imagine them in impossible situations, and oblige them to think their way clear as quickly as they could. If Knocker wasn't satisfied, they would have to do it again, and then again. They were tired all the time. About 1 o'clock on a gray afternoon towards the end of the fortnight, Spiff, with 2 or 3 other stewards from the High Street, made an appearance in the storeroom of Rowena Crescent Gym. It was the beginning of the rest period, and Spiff walked around the room talking to the Borables, who were stretched out on their sleeping bags, dozing, with only their eyes half open. When he'd had a short word with each, he came over to speak with Knocker and Dodger. "Afternoon, Knocker," said Spiff, nodding his head abruptly at the two stewards by his side. "This is Rasher, and this is Ziggy." Knocker stood up and said, "Those are fine names. Certainly I would like to hear the stories one day." The two stewards nodded but did not smile. They looked out of humor. "Yes," said Spiff. "I will have to wait, of course. Now, Knocker, you've reached the end of your 2 weeks. How have you got on?" Knocker reached for the large book on his desk. It contained detailed descriptions of each Borable's training, together and with various comments. Spiff waved it aside. "No, I can look at that later. Just a verbal report will do." "Keep it general, too," said Rasher acidly. "Well," said Knocker, looking sideways at Dodger, "they are very good, all of them. Some are better at one thing or another, but they're all naturals with the catapult. They could knock off a running cat with their eyes closed. Girls as well. In fact, Charlotte's better than all the others. Perhaps better than a rococo. Hand-to-hand fighting's good, climbing's good, running very fast. With the rumble stick, they vary, but Bingo is fantastic. They aren't so good at scouting work in the countryside, but that takes years of practice. It's unnatural, and they're first class in the streets and the markets. You'll hardly see their hands come up from beneath a barrow when they strike for their dinner. Marvelous, all of them are dead keen." Knocker hesitated and lowered his voice. "I'm only worried about one of them, although he's worked as hard as anyone. Harder. But I don't know. There's something that worries me about Napoleon Boot. He always seems to be thinking about something else, and there's a slimy feel to him. It's, well, to tell you the truth, Spiff, I don't know. It's just a feeling." Dodger nodded, and the three stewards to substantiate what Knocker had said. Spiff looked back down the hall to where the Borables were resting. Some of them were reading the rumble books, others were just relaxing and looking at the ceiling. Napoleon Boot was scrutinizing the road map of Greater London and memorizing street names. "He never stops," said Knocker. "They all know the Borable Book proverbs by heart. But Napoleon knows it backwards and sideways as well. He's too good to be true." Spiff creased his face. "Well, son, there's nothing we can do now. They have to have a Wendell with them because they've got to cross the Wandle. You know how suspicious they are of anybody who wants to cross their bloody river." He sniffed. "It ought to be all right. I mean, the adventure's in their best interest, ain't it? The Rumbles could easily burrow under Wandsworth Common and move from there down to the streets. The Wendells are in more danger than we are, because they simply are nearer to Rumbledom, ain't they? It'll work out. You'll see." There was a silence as if nobody agreed with him, not even Spiff himself. He changed the subject. "Well, your blokes must leave soon anyway. The longer they wait, the more dangerous it is. There's a psychological advantage in letting the Rumbles know we're onto 'em, but the longer we take getting up there, the more they'll have to prepare their defenses. Our 8 might not be able to get into the Rumble Burrow. Imagine! All that way for nothing!" Ziggy, who had been trying to interrupt Spiff's flow, got his last word in. I never liked this idea, you know, Spiff. I think we should have gone up there in force, taken him on, given him a thumping, duffed him up.
Out of your mind, said Spiff impatiently. He was always right, and he knew it.
We've been outnumbered, 10-1. They've been fighting on their own ground. We stand a much better chance by sending out 8 professionals like this and eliminating their leaders. Mark my words.
Oh, it sounds all right on paper, said Ziggy condescendingly. And I don't think that those 8 over there can manage it. They haven't done anything yet. Anyone can fire a catapult at a woolly and run. But if it's a rumble, with a rumble stick at your throat, eh?
Look, said Knocker, getting annoyed. I've trained this lot. If anyone can get inside the rumble burrow, they can.
Rubbish, said Rasher, joining in the argument. They don't stand a monkey's.
They do, said Knocker.
They don't, said Ziggy.
The stewards frowned at their feet. Spiff sniffed again.
I've been looking at the map, Knocker. I thought that the 8 might ought to go up the Thames. But from St. Mary's to Wandsworth Reach?
I know it's dangerous, but it will save days on the journey. It means the 8 will be going in from a direction the Rumbles won't dream of. Even they got lookouts deployed as far as Wandsworth Common, Railway, and Earlsfield. We'll outflank 'em. What do you say?
Knocker was angry all over again. But Spiff, he cried, grabbing his steward's arm, the river is a death trap. All those barges and tugs and police launches, they'd be run down or run in without a chance. They've had no training for water. I don't even know if they can row. I thought they were going to march over land. And now you want to throw them in the river?
It's not on, Spiff.
How far do you think they'd get if they went over land, asked Ziggy, with a solid line of rumbles from Merton to the River Thames?
Rasher shoved his face up to Knocker's and tilted it sideways.
If your blokes are so good, why are you making excuses? Can't they do it?
It's a question of time. Training, sputtered Knocker. Spiff nodded.
Just so. You'll get an extra day for boat training and rowing.
Oh, but we haven't got a boat, said Knocker, looking at the 3 stewards as if they were mad.
Oh, yeah, you'll need a boat, said Spiff, to row up the river. You'll need one before you train in, won't you?
Where can we get one? Asked Doddridge, looking distraught.
Spiff turned on him angrily. You're abhorrible, ain't you? Steal one, this afternoon, instead of kipping.
Yes, said Ziggy, let's see how good this team is. But I'll tell you can't get over this little problem. I shall use all my influence to see that this adventure is cancelled. I never liked it, you know.
Spiff laughed. Don't you take your notice of him. I know you'll manage, Knocker. Just to prove us and your blokes are as good as they say they are, eh?
And with that, the 3 stewards climbed up the wall on the exercise bars, and one by one they disappeared through the narrow windows that led to Rowena Crescent. Knocker was shaking with temper as he watched them go. He had a tendency to take things seriously at the best of times, but this criticism of his team and his training of them was a personal insult.
Just like that, eh? He said to Dodger. Get a boat, steal it, launch it, learn how to row, just like that.
And only today and tomorrow to do it in? Said Dodger soberly.
Knocker walked over to where the 8 were waiting, propped up on their elbows, their interest aroused by the discussion.
Well, he said, no rest for the wicked. Get your hats on. I'm taking you to the lake in Battersea Park, and we're going to steal a boat.
Only one person among the 8 registered enthusiasm. Napoleon's dark face became brilliant. He stood up and said, a boat, eh? That's good. Know about boats we do up the Wandle.
Knocker was relieved, of course. The Wandsworth Borables live near the water all the time. Napoleon Boot would be a great help. We're going to have to steal a boat that can make up the river trip along the Thames as far as the mouth of the Wandle. Napoleon, can you teach the team how to row and steer?
Why, of course, Knocker, said Napoleon with a slight sneer and coloring of his voice.
It'll be a pleasure.
One by one, they slipped from the gym and went their separate ways to the park. They reassembled by huge iron gates and walked along the roadway till they arrived at the boating lake. Each Borable had his hat well down over their ears, a catapult under his jumper, and a few stones ready in the pocket just in case.
Knocker felt sad, for soon the 8 would be gone, and what an adventure it would be like for them. What times they would have, but he, Knocker, would be left behind and forgotten. He had worried about it every day, but think as he might, he could see no way by which all he could wrangle his way into inclusion in the team. They would set off on the perilous journey to Rumbledom. He shook the desire from his mind. It was no use thinking about it. It was not long before he and the others came in sight of the small wooden hut where the tickets were sold to those who wished to spend an hour boating. The high summer season was nearly over, and most of the boats were chained to one of the islands in the middle of the lake out of harm's way. Only about a dozen or so were roped into the little jetty which stood near the ticket office. Inside a wooden shed was a park keeper with a brown suit and a brown hat. He was licking a pencil and writing slowly in a big book. Not one boat moved on the flat surface of the water. Knocker and the others sat down by the edge of the path to watch. After a while, Knocker said, "What do you think of the boats, Napoleon?" "We're a bit too far away to judge," said the Wendell. "But you see, they've got some metal ones out there by the jetty." His voice changed when he talked about boats. He became excited. His face shone, while his companions looked terrified. Borables tend to dislike water even more than they dislike woods and fields. They aren't really good for a river trip. Too short and wide. Unstable. Not big enough anyway to take 8 of us. "Those are the ones we want," he pointed out to the islands. The others could see amongst the scores of metal boats were a few old long ones, built of wood, seats and cushions and rudders that were worked by 2 pieces of rope. They were much bigger. "Lovely, graceful things they are," said Napoleon enthusiastically. "Low in the water, they will float over any wave or wash-up cast by barges on the river. 4 rowlocks? I should think 2 teams of rowers, if the girls are up to it." He looked behind him at Shallot and Sydney. Shallot said, "Get your boat first, Wendell." "Take it easy," said Knocker, stopping any quarrel before it started. "If we want one of those wooden boats from the island, we're going to have to get out there. Any ideas?" "Too far to swim," said the Vulgarian, who they all called Bulge now. "And he won't hire us one, because we're too small," said Sydney, "even if we had the money, which we haven't." "So we'll have to pinch a metal boat to get out there," added Stonks. "Yeah, but have you noticed," said Tory Cannon, "they keep all the oars separate and only hand them out with the boats, don't they? And worse, the boats tied to the island ain't got no oars at all." There was a silence. Knocker waited. This was all part of the training. He knew what he would have done, and the situation obviously called for diversionary tactics of some kind. Someone would have to entice the keeper out of the little shed so that others could dash in and get some oars. Something like that was necessary. Suddenly, Napoleon Boots stood up. "Look," he said, "boats is my speciality. Why don't you let me do it?" "All right," said Knocker. "Who do you want to take with you?" "No, I want to do this one on my own." "On your own?" cried Bulge. "I'd like to see it." "You will," answered Napoleon. "You will." "Well, it better be good," said the chief lookout. "We haven't got time to waste." "Just after nightfall tonight, you will have your pick of boats," said Napoleon scornfully. "And you'll be able to row this lot of sailors up and down until their arms drop off. How's that?" "That'll do me fine, Napoleon Boots," said Knocker grimly. Napoleon left them and went downside a path towards the little hut on the jetty. He swaggered as he walked. The others retreated and screened themselves in some bushes. When they were settled, Arakako said, "That Napoleon may smell a little bit, but I bet you there's no flies on him." They watched as the Wendell strut towards the wooden shed. At the end of the jetty he halted, pulled his hat down over his ears, and then walked straight past. "What's the little bleeder up to now?" asked Dodger to no one in particular, and he got no answer. When Napoleon was small in the distance, he suddenly turned and ran as fast as he could back towards the hut. He dashed to the ticket office, threw open the door, and jumping up and down, he yelled to the keeper inside. What he said the watchers could not imagine, but they could see that Napoleon was very agitated. The keeper listened attentively, and then he got up quickly from his stool and came out onto the jetty, passing only to lock the door of his hut. "That's no good," groaned Bingo. "We can't get in there now." The keeper threw 2 oars into the nearest boat, picked up the tiny Napoleon, and jumped on board. The boat rocked and swayed dangerously, but it did not capsize. Napoleon seemed quite happy sitting on the stern as the keeper set the oars in the rowlocks and plied them expertly. The little craft shot out into the lake, heading for the larger of the 2 islands where the unused boats were tied along the shore in rows. Knocker looked at Dodger and shook his head. "Blessed if I know where he's at," he said. Dodger shrugged his shoulders. The boat neared the island, but before it touched the shore, they could see that Napoleon had got to his feet. Then the boat hit the bank, stopping abruptly, and the Wendell was shot off his feet into the water. Tory Cannon roared with laughter. "Cocky little stinker's fallen in," he guffawed, and the others laughed too. "Shut up," snarled Knocker. The park keeper stepped into the water, wetting his trousers to the waist, and rescued Napoleon,
placing the bauble in the boat and wrapping him in a rug that he took from the bench. Then he tied the boat to a branch, and wagging his finger at Napoleon, he disappeared into the island's vegetation. No sooner had he gone than the watchers were amazed to see Napoleon leap up, untie the painter, row for the shore, and boy could that boy row. He was small, but he made that boat into a living thing, and it flew across the lake like a kingfisher. Knocker looked at the faces all around him. Jaws were open, and eyes were wide. Napoleon jumped onto the jetty. Without bothering to moor the boat, he ran along the wooden planking to the path, darted to the telephone box that stood empty nearby. The bauble saw him climb up a couple of the broken window panes to reach the receiver more easily, and he made a call. That done, he raced off at top speed to be lost amongst some trees about a half a mile away. For while nothing happened, the watchers in the bushes stirred uneasily. "I think that cocky little so-and-so is out of his mind," said Stonks. "All he's done is stir up trouble." "I don't know so much," said Sidney. "Let's wait and see." And so they waited, and they waited, and after what seemed a long while, but in reality it was only 10 minutes, they heard the hoo-ha, hoo-ha, hoo-ha of a police siren, and a patrol car skidded to a halt by the telephone box. "Oh, lor, here comes the Woolies now," said Dodger warily. Two policemen threw themselves out of the car, ran to the landing stage, and tried the door in the little hut, but it was firmly locked. Then there was a hollowing and a whistling from the island. Looking up, the policeman saw the keeper jumping up and down and waving his arms and making an awful noise. He must have been quite cold, because the bauble's could see the bottom half of him was darker than the top, which meant he was still very wet. Two policemen poked about their boats for some oars, but they were all in the hut. The only oars available were in the boat that the keeper and Napoleon had used, but that had drifted until it was about 10 yards from inland. The policemen tried to hook it with a long pole, but they couldn't quite reach. Another police car arrived with an inspector in it, and he took control and ordered one of his men to go out and get the boat. One of the constables took off his coat and waded into the lake, but the bottom shelved away fairly rapidly, and by the time he got the boat he was swimming. Sputtering and cursing his luck, he got a hold of the painter and pulled the boat back to the jetty, and a dry policeman got in and rowed to the island, where it was the work of a minute to rescue the keeper. While the boat was returning to shore, head keeper bowled up on his bicycle and stood joking with the police inspector. They thought the episode was most hilarious. They threw back their heads and laughed and laughed. Water does that to some people. Very soon the wet policeman and the damp keeper were together on the jetty, and the inspector sent them off in one of the cars. The head keeper unlocked the shed, put the oars away, and locked it up again. He stood talking and laughing some more with the inspector. Then they shook hands, and the keeper got on his bike, pedaled back to his office. The inspector drove back to the police station on Lavender Hill. It was all over. Everything was quiet, and dusk began to come down over the park. The deer who lived behind the railings had already disappeared into their wooden shelters. Only a few people were strolling about, and all those were making their way to the gates. Very soon a bell would ring, and Battersea Park would close for the night. The waiting and watching bauibles undid their packs, took out their great coats, and squatted down, expecting they knew not what. "I hardly see the point of this operation," said Sidney. She always spoke a little precisely like that. "The hut is locked, and there are no oars outside. I think Napoleon has made a miscalculation somewhere." Just then, at that moment, there was a rustle in the bushes behind them, and a very bedraggled Napoleon Boot ran up. He was panting and laughing so much that he looked like he might be sick. His hair was plastered down over his skull, his clothes were soaking and stuck to his body, and his skin was steaming from the heat generated by his mad running across the park. He fell to the ground, and the sounds coming from him made his companions think that perhaps he was very ill. Knocker pulled the sodden bauble onto his back and peeled off the wet jacket. He then removed his own greatcoat and covered the shaking, shivering body with it. "It looks bad," said Dodger. "Man," Arakako cried, "we don't want a casualty before we even start." The bauble stood in a glum group, looking down at Napoleon. Knocker rubbed the hands and legs of the Wandsworth bauble as hard as he could to aid in circulation. Gradually, Napoleon got his breath and sat up. "Don't fuss," he said between gasps. "I'm all right. Just a bit out of breath, and I can't stop laughing." As if to prove it, he started shaking and shivering again. "There's nothing to laugh about," said Knocker sternly, relieved now that he knew Napoleon Boot would survive. "We've wasted a whole afternoon, achieved nothing except for you to have a good giggle." Napoleon groped into his wet clothes. There was a jangling noise, and his hand reappeared clutching a massive bunch of keys. "Look at that," he chortled. "What's that, eh? Scotch mist?" There was a stunned silence, and then Bingo asked, "Well, what is it?" Napoleon rolled over with merriment. "It's the keys to the hut, of course," he sputtered, when he had recovered sufficiently. "To the whole bleedin' park, I shouldn't wonder." "How'd you do it?" asked Dodger. "Well," said Napoleon, "I went dashing up to the hut, pretended to cry my eyes out. 'It's my dog,' I said, 'it's my dog.' He laughed again, and the others began to laugh, too. 'He swam over to the island,' says I. 'He's such a little frightened, lovely dog, he can't swim back.' 'That's all right,' said the keeper. 'Soon we'll get him, no trouble.' And you saw what happened after that. He goes and locks the door of the flaming hut, so plan A was gone in a trice. When we got near the island, I pretend to get all excited about the dog, don't I? I jumps up and down and says, 'There he is! There he is!' And so I falls in with a splash. Well, the keeper has kittens at that, and leaps into the effect of a rescue, as they might say. And, well, the whole crux of the point was plan B. He's carrying me back to the boat, and I lifts the keys out of his pocket. Well, he's all for bringing me back right away, and never mind the dog. 'No, no,' says I. 'I'll get all hell beaten out of me at home.' Well, you saw the rest. I pinches the boat, gets on the blower back to old Bill, tells him that Keeper 347 has been marooned on a desert island in the middle of Battersea Park while rescuing a dog. Then I takes off the other direction. Now we got the keys." And he jangled them in front of Knocker's face. "We can take the boats when we like. Practice all night." Knocker, just like I said. And Napoleon rolled over and laughed so loudly that the others had to put a coat over his head to deaden the noise. Knocker stood up, shook his head in admiration. The others did the same. They looked at each other in deepening gloom and chuckled and felt confident. As soon as they had eaten the rations they had brought, the Borables crept down to the hut on the lake where they had no difficulty in opening the door, stealing the oars they needed. They crowded together in one of the small metal crafts, and Napoleon rowed them out to the center of the lake. They waited while the Wendell expected one of the larger boats. They were fine, long, comfortable things, possessing four wide seats with cushions, and lots of space for stowing gear in the fore and aft. But they were solid, heavy, and would need scientific rowing. Napoleon chose the best one, and came back to report to Knocker. "Number 17. Been well looked after." As the group moved to embark, he pulled Knocker aside, grasping his elbow. "I think the boat will be too heavy for just four to row," he said quietly. "There will have to be two of us on each oar. That means when it comes to the actual trip, there will be no turn and turn about. We will have to row all the time." Knocker thought about it for a second. "You'll have to row by night and hide by day. That'll keep well away from police launches. They'll run you in as soon as they look at you. Won't take them half a second to suss out a bunch of Borables in a stolen pleasure boat." But at that moment, they didn't worry too much about the future. The novelty of boating occupied and amused them, and even Knocker took a hand. Napoleon made them work very hard indeed, for they only had that night in which to learn the art of rowing. Napoleon sat in the stern and steered the boat with the two pieces of rope that were attached to the side of the rudder behind him. Dodger sat up front to make sure they didn't run into anything. Though the moon had come up, it was easy to see far over the silver water. They sat two to an oar, as Napoleon had suggested, for they would need a great deal of power when they were out on the River Thames. Not only would they have to contend with the tide, but there would be waves washing outward from passing barges and tugs. There would be always danger of collision. Napoleon gave them their positions in the boat and told them to keep them, except that he would take Knocker's place on the expedition because Knocker wouldn't be going. "When we're on the river," Napoleon said, "there'll only be eight of us. There'll be no one on the rudder. That means we will have to steer by rowing. Listen very carefully to my commands and act on them immediately. Anyone being a bit slow could get us the rundown. Capsized. We'll lose all our equipment, and worse, we could drown." And so Napoleon went on. He taught them the basic rowing commands: how to begin rowing, how to stop, how to feather the oars, how to learn to pull steady and hard without wasting too much of their energy. Next time they got into the boat, they would be on the wide, thronged rudder of the River Thames itself. All through the night, they rowed and listened to Napoleon Boot, navigator. As the hours wore on, they realized what a serious thing a river trip would be, and they looked at each other with concern. Their minds grew numb with the physical effort. Blisters rose on their hands, and still Napoleon kept them rowing, till they could row as near as any Wendell, and could change course as the slightest order from the stern. Only when the sky had paled,
and Don climbed over the blocks of the flats along Battersea Park Road to Napoleon direct them to the lakeside. Thankfully, the Borables obeyed the command to ship oars, and they sighed when they heard the prow of their boat grate on the gravel on the shore. They sat motionless for a while, their heads bowed, their muscles tight. Dodger, who had done little all this time, stood up in the prow, stretched, and then jumped ashore. "Come on, you lot," he said. "We gotta hide this boat before we're spotted by the keepers." Nearby was a dense clump of bushes, and the Borables manhandled the heavy boat into the middle of them. They stumbled and tripped over their own feet, so tired were they, having been awake for 24 hours without a break. They tore foliage from the bushes and grass and from the ground, and camouflaged the boat so well that it could hardly be seen even from a distance of a yard or two. When he was quite satisfied, Knocker ordered the team of Borables back to base. It was full daylight by the time they reached the Prince's Head, and the lines of lady cleaners were already chatting at the bus stops as the Borables turned into Rowena Crescent. They climbed into the basement gym, crawled under their sleeping bags and blankets, which were laid out on exercise mats. There were loud groans and sighs of relief as they closed their eyes, stretched their burning limbs, but Knocker could not sleep for a while. He kept asking himself the same question over and over again. Now that we've got it, how do we get it from Battersea Park to Battersea Reach?